Yeah, let's get going. I think people are filtering in. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 3 of our current series of Employment Law 101. Our theme this year, if you've joined us before, is all about the cost of living crisis and how it's impacting on the employment relationship from various different angles. For those of you that don't know us, my name is Peter Beastie. I'm an employment law partner with Specialist Employment Practice, MPM Legal. And I'm delighted to be joined by my colleague this morning, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Good morning, everybody, on this fine, wet morning.
Soggy day in South Oxfordshire. We are specialist employment and immigration practice. We're based in the south of England, but we have clients that are all over the world, and they have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. Delighted to be joined live by so many of you this morning. For those of you that are listening on our podcast, and I've got to say this now that we're on Spotify and Apple Music and other good podcast providers, what we're talking about today is relevant as of the 2nd of November 2023, just in case you're listening to this in 5 years' time and I don't know, employment law
doesn't... horribly out of date.
...report and replaced by AI or robots. So please bear that in mind. For those of you that are joining us live today, though, you have the fantastic opportunity to ask us some questions, and we absolutely love questions, don't we?
As long as we can answer them, yes.
As long as they're easy ones. ask away. If you're going to ask a question, please just use the Q&A box down at the bottom of the screen. And that's simply because it's just a bit easier for us to manage what's been responded to and track it that way. But feel free to use the chat function if you want to send a message more widely to the group, or Q&A if you just want us to see your question. So what are we talking about today, Adrienne?
Trade unions, pretty topical, really, given that, you know, there's been lots of trade union activity, hasn't there? I mean, only yesterday, I think I saw that school staff in Scotland walked out in a dispute over pay. I think they're saying they weren't paid enough and they were having to buy resources out of their own money. And then, of course, we've just had the U-turn on the rail ticket office closures, which Mick Lynch will be absolutely delighted about, and I should imagine would probably galvanise quite a lot of trade union activity, thinking that, you know, if you stick it out for long enough and you press hard enough, you can get what you want. So I think it's certainly something that we're seeing more and more of.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that in the last 18 months, we as a firm have done more trade union related work than ever. It's something that we have always done, but it's generally just been ticking along quite nicely in the background. But there's been a lot more activity over the last 18 months. And of course, I think that is inevitably driven by the cost of living crisis, right? In terms, particularly around pay negotiations, and a push for more involvement. If you joined us for our last session a couple of weeks ago, we were looking at a bit of crystal ball gazing in terms of what a change government might mean as well for UK employment rights. And we know what Labour have been saying as a result of the recent party conference season. you know, they've been talking about greater trade union involvement within the workplace, be that an easier method of trade union recognition, or just enhanced rights in terms of trade union membership and representation as well. So there could be a direction of travel here. And we just thought it was an opportune moment just to go over some of those Employment 101 basics around trade union recognition and what's involved. So just a few stats for you to kick things off. The share of employees that were members of a trade union in 2022 was 22.3%, which is a super specific number, but 22.3% of the UK workforce. Now, that's been a relatively stable number since 2015. But since 2022, there's been a massive wave of industrial disputes. So in December 2022 alone, so less than a year ago, 829,000 working days lost to industrial action. In July 2023, which I think is the most recent month that data is available, it was still at 281,000 days lost to industrial action. So you can see how certainly industrial action, at least, really has an impact on the economy and, you know, disruption to businesses. By March 2023, there were 303,000 UK workers who were involved in some kind of labour dispute with their employer. So, you know, they're quite large numbers.
Mm. Where does those I wonder how they gather those stats and they work out the lost working days. It's quite fascinating, isn't it? But if you think about things like the train strikes, that means people can't get to work. Businesses have had to close. They, you know, you lose retail stuff. All of that. It has quite a knock on effect, doesn't it? Let alone just within your own business.
Oh yeah, massively. I mean, for anyone who's interested in looking at the statistical data, I'll probably put some links up onto LinkedIn later actually today. But there's a lot of really good information from Statista, which is one of the research companies, and it's all backed up in terms of their research methodology. So if you have an interest in this area, you've got any clients or you're being asked to provide some information, then Google is your friend. But I'll post a link on LinkedIn, I think, later on. So what about trade unions and the workplace then? Well, as we know, and as you'll all be familiar with, all employees, irrespective of whether or not you as a business recognize a trade union, already have certain employment right protections regarding trade unions. And, you know, the most obvious ones that we encounter are the right to be accompanied to disciplinary and grievance hearings. That right is to be accompanied by a colleague or a trade union representative. And it's quite a common question, I think, Adrienne, isn't it, about don't recognize a trade union?
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if the individual is a member of a trade union, they can bring their rep with them, whether you recognise a trade union or not. And that's something that actually most employers probably overlook.
And there are also rights as well, aren't there, around withholding offers of employment, for example, from people who are trade union members on the grounds of their trade union membership.
Have you ever seen that?
I was just going to say they're quite new claims. I mean, I haven't seen a dispute in relation to that specifically. Like the more common one we get asked about is being accompanied to meetings, but it is a right, and perhaps in some sectors it is more prevalent actually.
There's also, of course, not just like withholding offers of employment, but they're suffering a detriment generally. And this is something that I definitely have come across, which is we don't want to promote that person because they're a trade union rep and a pain in the backside. So I have come across that. But remember that if that is within your thinking and do not write it down, then that's potentially a detriment, which is an actionable claim by the employee.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a fairly niche area, and hopefully none of you are going to get into trouble on those grounds. So let's talk about trade union recognition, shall we?
Let's. Yes.
So in terms of what trade union recognition is, well, simply it's where there's a direct relationship between your business or your client's business for some of you, but a business and a trade union. So there's a direct relationship there. And there's a couple of ways in terms of how that direct relationship can come about. Now, the easiest way for that is something called voluntary trade union recognition. And basically that occurs when the trade union writes to the business and basically says, hey, we're such and such trade union. We think that we enjoy a certain level of support amongst employees that you employ in your business. And we would like you to recognize us as the official trade union representing this specific group of employees. Now, it's entirely up to the trade union to decide what it thinks the group of employees it's representing should be identified as. It might be a certain management level, it might be a certain grade of employees. It could be all employees employed at X particular office. It could be all employees working at Y particular warehouse, whatever. There's a bit of free rein there. But fundamentally, the employer, the trade union gets in touch and says, we'd like to go for this recognition. We think you should recognize us for these reasons. Now, the easiest way through is the employer says, oh, yes, OK, fine. We're happy to recognize you. And then the employer and the trade union enter into a voluntary recognition agreement. So they enter into an agreement between them, and that agreement basically sets the rules.
Mm. I think what the sort of like the process around, I'm just thinking about some of the pitfalls that we've come across or some of the questions we've been asked is, you know, very often the employer is going to be very resistant to wanting trade union recognition, which is always really difficult. And of course, one of the things that you can do is become embroiled in whether or not you've got sufficient support and, you know, how is the union how's the union sort of gathered its data, by what means, how can all of that data be challenged? So, you know, I think you were going to come on and mention the statutory process, but there are lots of ways in which you push back and you end up in a kind of long drawn out dispute about whether or not the trade union even meets the thresholds. But I suppose from our experience, it's, you know, once you've gathered your own data where you think, okay, actually we can see where the trade union is going to meet that statutory threshold, then I suppose my advice there would be, why push back for pushing back's sake? Because if you've done your data, it looks like the thresholds are going to be met. You know, it's really not worth getting embroiled in what is then a long drawn out legal process to challenge it, when the chances are you're probably going to have to recognize them anyway. I think, you know, it's far better to start your life with the trade union recognition in a more collaborative way, because at least you set the tone, because we all know what happens in any dispute. Both parties end up being polarized in their views. The relationship then is already fractious. Whereas, you know, if you think you're going to have to recognize them anyway, go, OK, all right, let's sit down, talk about it. And that way you start the relationship well, and then you've probably got much better chance of narrowing down the scope of what's going to be in your collective agreement in terms of what you can negotiate. You know, so I don't know, Peter, would you want to talk about what would be sort of, what are the basics under sort of statutory?
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's just divorce out the statutory process from the voluntary process. So we're just talking here about the voluntary recognition process, where the union says, will you recognize us? And the employer says, yes, we're happy to, or we're content to, maybe let's put it that way. You have this recognition agreement between the employer and the trade union, and it provides for this concept of collective bargaining. So basically a method of negotiation between the two parties. And what does that collective bargaining agreement cover? Well, typically it will be the fundamental terms and conditions of employment of the employees who are in that bargaining unit. So that's the group of employees that you're agreeing to recognize the trade union in respect of. And that could be a really small number of employees, or it could be hundreds or thousands of employees. But it will cover the terms and conditions of employment. It will cover perhaps hiring and firing processes to do with those employees. It will cover disciplinary matters, so how certain disciplinary processes work. It may cover some more practical arrangements around trade union facilities. So what facilities have been made available to permanently employed trade union officials? So there'll be people within your business that you employ. So they're your employees, but they are also an official of the trade union that you're recognizing. So what facilities can they access, when, you know, time scales, what sort of time, paid time from work is allocated for them to be able to do their trade union functions. And significantly as well, of course, pay negotiation arrangements as well. So pay bargaining. So when will those pay negotiations take place? What's the methodology around trying to reach agreement about pay negotiations? And I think it's this one that we've seen the most focus on in the last 18 months.
Yeah.
Now, one thing around that I would say is you don't necessarily need a written agreement. Obviously, we're going to advocate as lawyers that you write down everything that you want to agree with a party, because it stands as evidence of what the arrangement is, and it really narrows down the scope of dispute over what you're engaging the union on. But the law doesn't require there to be a written agreement with the union in order for you to have recognised a trade union. Now, why that is relevant is you just have to be a bit wary of engaging with trade unions and thinking, well, we're talking to this trade union about this thing, but we've not formally recognised them, you know, so actually it doesn't have any consequence. That could be quite a fundamental mistake to make. So just be cautious in terms of talking to trade unions about some of those things, you know, hiring, firing, terms and conditions of employment, pay, other conditions, without a written agreement being in place, because there is the prospect of inadvertently recognizing the trade union, you know, when you don't mean to. Should we talk a little bit about the collective agreement as well?
Yeah, because that's the first thing that we ask to look at when we get queries on trade unions. It's like, what does your collective agreement say?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one thing I'd say about collective agreements, and I know you and I were talking about this previously, is sometimes they're very, very old documents and they're kind of no longer fit for purpose. I was looking at one recently that I think was from 1973. So, you know, under a whole, you know, the Employment Rights Act wasn't enforced then. Trade Union Labour Relations Consolidation Act wasn't enforced then. It's a whole different legislative thing. I'm not even sure whether industrial tribunals had been set up by that date, actually, possibly. My knowledge
I'm not sure. Well, the precursor to the Employment Rights Act was 1978. So that would probably be so when the tribunals were set up.
Yeah, predated the precursor to the ERA. So, yeah, one thing to look out for there is whether a written agreement is still fit for purpose because there's a means of updating them. But one important point about the collective agreement between the business and the trade union is that that agreement is not legally enforceable. So it's not enforceable as a contract between the trade union and the employer. However, those terms that are agreed between a trade union and the employer can be incorporated into individual employment contracts. So you kind of have this funny three-way relationship, really, where there isn't a contractually enforceable agreement between trade union and employer, but as a result of negotiations undertaken under that agreement with the trade union, you can have employees enforcing those agreements directly with you as the employer. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, when you see in contracts of employment, it's like, you know, the various bits that need to go in, you'll see the sentence, there are no collective agreements applicable to your employment. That's when there is no trade union agreement that needs to be, included. But if you do have that trade union recognition and the employee is part of that group, then you would see in the contract the provisions of the collective agreement between X and Y dated X applies to your employment. And that's how it then becomes incorporated. And that's a statutory requirement to go into the contract of employment.
Yeah, absolutely. And an example of, you know, what may be enforceable there is if, for example, you undertake pay negotiations with the trade union, you agree a certain pay grading, pay rating for certain grades, you then don't apply that. The union are not going to sue you for any breach of the collective bargaining process, but the individual's employees may sue you for breach of employment contract by saying, well, I can rely on the agreement that was reached between you as my employer and the recognised trade union here. So that's how it fits together. Now, aside from those expressly, so the thing that Adrian was just talking about, those written incorporated terms in the employment contract, you've also got implied contractual terms as well. So I'm sure a lot of you will be familiar with the idea of implied terms into contracts of employment. So they're things that are not written down on a bit of paper that an employee can wave around, but they're arrangements that might be so notorious and certain within a particular business because they've been in place for years and everybody knows about them and they're very, very clear, that they just become and form part and parcel of the employment contract. And that's the same with these sorts of arrangements as well. So there can be implied incorporation of certain terms relevant to things that have been agreed with trade unions that still form part and parcel of your employees' contracts of employment. Okay. So what does it mean if you recognize a trade union? There are a couple of things associated with that. For you, as businesses, you've got to be mindful of your legal obligations in terms of providing information to the trade union. So once you've got that recognition agreement in place, there are certain things, certain bits of information that must be provided at certain points in the employment relationship. Now, helpfully, and Adrian, I'm a fan of the ACAS information that they provide. There is an ACAS code on this, isn't there, in relation mm-hmm. to collective bargaining. So if you want to have a look, in fact,
you carry on talking. I can always put it in the chat.
Yeah, if you just bring up the it's Code of Practice of Disclosure of Information to Trade Unions, you can maybe stick it into the chat. So there's a really useful ACAS Code of Practice, which is worth a look at. It's pretty old. It's quite old. It's 20 years old. I think it's from 2003. But all the principles in there are still super relevant. So that's helpful in explaining to you and your clients what information needs to be provided to the trade union and when. Now, when you're thinking about general obligations regarding the trade union, if your business is ever involved in a collective redundancy situation, so 20 or more people within a 90-day period, If you're ever involved in a 2B transfer situation because you're buying a business and incorporating some employees into your company, if you're outsourcing a critical service to a third party, you've got first generation outsourcing and 2B provisions are engaged, and indeed in respect of certain health and safety obligations as well, then you've got to consult and you've got to inform and where appropriate consult with your recognised trade union. So the fact that you've got a trade union recognised means you go to that trade union to do that. If you didn't have a recognised trade union, of course, some of you will have been through collective consultation exercises, that's where you go to the employees and they elect employee representatives and you run your consultation process through those. It's different where you've got the recognised trade union. You've got to go to the union first. So their obligations regarding you, what about individual obligations for your employees, which kick in because you've recognised a trade union? Well, of course, like I said at the outset, there's a whole bunch of rights that sit around trade unions in the workplace already, but there are extra rights that are applicable to trade union officials that you employ. So rights of access to certain facilities and a reasonable amount of time off to be able to do their duties. So you need to be mindful of those employment rights. However, probably the most significant one that we've seen is around collective bargaining and direct inducements, isn't it, Adrian?
Yeah, absolutely. So just not falling foul of cutting across the process of pay negotiations directly between you and the union.
Yeah, absolutely. Where we typically see it is where there's been a stalling in terms of pay negotiations with a union and the employer is really, really tempted just to go directly to the employees, perhaps because they're getting the sense that quite a lot of the employees just want to accept the pay offer and they go directly to the employees and make an offer. The big, big risk there is that you're circumventing the collective bargaining process and there's a specific breach of laws. I was going to say offence, I suppose, but there's probably a better way to describe it. But if you go ahead and do that, then you're at risk of inducing employees to circumvent the collective bargaining process. So it obviously undermines the whole trade union process, and there is a specific liability for it. Now, there are particular circumstances where it is permitted to do that, but they are very, very narrow. There was a case, I think it went all the way to the Supreme Court, maybe it was the Court of Appeal, called Costal, which looked at all the principles around when you can go directly to employees, but they're quite narrow. And I think if you're ever in that situation, then obviously come and get some advice from us, ideally, please, but just take some advice and speak to your representatives around that. Pay negotiations and going directly is where you can fall foul. You're supposed to use the trade union collective bargaining mechanism. Shall we talk a bit about the statutory recognition process?
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very rigid, isn't it, in terms of its steps. And I suppose I would say that with a health warning, I would only be looking to go into this process if you had good information to show that what the union was telling you was something that you didn't agree with. But yeah, by all means.
Yeah, so have a quick look at it. I mean, like Adrian says, it's very rigid. It's also very, very technical. There are a lot of super technical rules around it, more so than other areas of employment law, probably because I think it's largely governed by the Trade Union Labour Relations Consolidation Act, which is quite an unwieldy bit of legislation. So what we're talking about here specifically is when the trade unions come to you and said, hey, we'd like to be recognised, please. We want to represent this group of employees. And you as a business have said, no, we don't fancy that. Thanks very much. The union then think, well, we think we've got enough support to force this through. So what they will do is trigger the statutory recognition procedure. Now, it's important to note that this can only cover the three areas of pay, hours of work, and holidays. So any mandatory recognition that is forced on you as an employer as a result of this process we're going to talk about can only cover those three things: pay, hours, and holidays. It can cover anything else that you and the union agree to include, but if you're in this kind of fight, you're probably not going to want to include anything else anyway. So you're looking at three basic things.
And the union can't insist on anything else if they're going through this statutory process.
Yeah, absolutely. So In summary, because we're not going to get into the technical detail of it on a wet Thursday morning on this call, but in summary, here are what the steps look like. First of all, the union will make another written request to you as the employer. Now, you've got a few ways to respond to that request. You can either accept it, in which case you're talking about the collective bargaining agreement. Then you can negotiate what it's to do with, and then accept it. And you might want to negotiate, for example, on what the bargaining unit should look like, so which employees are going to be covered by the agreement. You can reject it and say, no, thanks, we're not interested. Or, of course, you can just stick your fingers in your ears and pretend it's never happened and not respond at all. And that does happen sometimes. Now, if you do either of rejecting the request or sticking your fingers in your ears, what can the union do next? Well, they will apply directly to a body called the Central Arbitration Committee, the CAC. That's an independent body. It's got statutory powers. Now, the CAC, on average, have dealt with one application every single week for the last 23 years. So quite a lot of applications. Some of those applications have been withdrawn. Some of those applications have not been determined. But on average, they're dealing with an application a week. The CAC are then going to look at some key things to decide what to do with the application. So first off, they're going to look at whether at least 10% of the workers in this proposed bargaining unit are actually members of the trade union that's asking to be recognised. So have they got that 10% threshold met? And they'll also want to look at, will a majority of workers, irrespective of whether they're trade union members or not, but will a majority of workers within that bargaining unit also support trade union recognition? So that's kind of like an initial gateway. And that's why Adrienne's saying, well, look, if you think it's likely the union can demonstrate those two things, they've got 10% membership and more than half the bargaining unit are going to support it, sort of question mark, is it sensible to engage in this fight going through this process?
I'm just going to jump in there as well, because there's lots of things that you can challenge, like what is the actual bargaining unit? Because they're going to want to try and they might want to try and scope it out quite narrowly in order to increase their chances of getting the numbers. You might say, well, it wouldn't be appropriate because we treat this group and that group the same. So we think that's the bargaining unit. So you can have all of those types of discussions trying to show that you can water down the percentage. You know, there's lots of scope for looking at it that way.
Yeah.
No. Earlier, but you know, that's something that I've done before.
Yeah, there's definite ways to challenge it. Well, that kind of neatly brings me on to the second thing the CAC are looking at, and that is the bargaining unit acceptable? So the CAC will look at it independently. Right. If they don't think it is acceptable, then they'll think, well, what should it be? So they'll make a suggestion as to what the bargaining unit should actually be. The third thing they'll look at is once that bargaining unit, so again, we're talking about the group of employees who are going to be covered by the recognition agreement. Once that bargaining unit has been decided or agreed, what's the level of support within that bargaining unit? So is there a groundswell of support of union membership, of union support for recognition? Now, how do they determine that? Well, they might just simply do a secret ballot. So you might have to arrange a secret ballot of the employees in that bargaining unit to try and find out whether enough people support it. The last thing they look at then is what's the method of collective bargaining? So how should it all work in practical terms? And again, if agreement can't be reached between the union or the prospective recognised union and the employer, the CAC will just impose it. So if all of these thresholds are met, ultimately you get the CAC imposing mandatory recognition. And that's what we mean by statutory recognition. So it's where the business has not voluntarily decided to enter into a voluntary agreement with the union that can be withdrawn at any time. Instead, the CAC have, after this process, imposed it on your business, and it's then in place for 3 years. So you're stuck with it for 3 years. Now, there is a three-year moratorium on applications. So if a trade union applies for a particular bargaining unit, no matter what the outcome is, so whether they get it or not, they're not allowed to make a further application for that bargaining unit for a three-year period. And that also means they can't make an application for a bargaining unit that's substantially similar. So they couldn't take a couple of employees in or out and say, oh, it's different to our original application. That's not permitted. The CAC can get joint applications as well from, say, two unions that want to be recognised jointly, or there might be competing applications from unions as well, and the CAC can decide what to do with those. So that's the mandatory statutory recognition process. What happens at the end? Well, after 3 years, you can apply to the CAC, funnily enough, for derecognition, and it's a process called statutory derecognition. And it's a similar process, but kind of in reverse, I guess. The CAC look again to see what level of support is, and if certain tests are met, it can order that the statutory recognition agreement is no longer valid and it disappears. So obviously, we've talked about voluntary recognition, so the voluntary process here. We've talked about the statutory, so the mandatory process. You can see now there's a massive advantage if you are going to have a recognised union to do it on a voluntary basis, simply because you've got that engagement piece. You can set the rules in terms of the collective bargaining process, and you can withdraw from it at any time. It's not an enforceable contractual agreement with the union. You contrast that with the statutory mechanism, you're not really in control of what's governed. It's imposed on you by the CAC, and it lasts for 3 years, so you're stuck with it. So there is a big disadvantage there.
Yeah.
Go on, Adrian. Absolutely. Are you going to jump in with a killer point?
Well, no, it's not really a killer point as well, because I'm sure most of you may well have been logging on to join us today to see if there's any magic over, or you know, what we can say about dealing with pay negotiations. And the answer is actually no, because most of the sort of like the legal aspects of trade union stuff is all around the recognition process and the collective working agreement. So I suppose what I think we should probably do is just come up with a few tips at the end. But with pay negotiations, it is a real case of just it's all about the comms. It's about having good business reasons for putting forward what you want and being clear with the trade unions about what the alternatives might be if you can't reach agreement. But other than that, as we've seen over the past 50 years or whatever, it really is a question of compromise. And then, frankly, who blinks first? Isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I think in terms of some tips, just to sort of finish off the session, I suppose one of the first things we would do is just say, like, if you recognise a union, when did you last review your collective working agreement? Is it still fit for purpose? Is it time for a refresh? But generally, are you aware of what's in it? Because it may well be that the trade union personnel involved are coming forward with certain aspects. And it may be that the answer to that is actually in writing between you. It's like, well, we don't have to talk to you about that, or we don't have to talk to you because our job is to negotiate with somebody else. So it's always worthwhile. It would be as I said, it's the first thing we ask for is what's in your written agreement. But you know, in terms of other changes, because it's obviously your agreement may not just be about pay, it might be about changes. I suppose, Peter, one of the questions where we get asked is what constitutes a change to working conditions and what constitutes a tweak to just say ways of working, for example, is a question we were asked quite recently, you know, because it may be your agreement says you've got to consult over contractual changes, but very often, you know, every single time you want to change something minorly, the union goes, you should consult with us. Well, how do we draw the line?
Yeah, I mean, I think normally I'd be looking at what the consequences of employees not agreeing that decision and kind of work back from that. So is it something that you ultimately want to try and force through, in which case there's scope for you being covered by the collective consultation obligations under the TULCRA, Trade Union Labour Relation Consolidation Act, because of the wider definition of redundancy within that bit of legislation. So then if that is triggered and you're then contemplating terminating some employment contracts because you want to rehire under new terms, the collective obligations are engaged. And what have we just talked about? Well, if you've got a recognised trade union, you do have to go back and talk to the trade union. But if you're not proposing to take that step, then arguably you don't need to engage because there's no proposal to dismiss. It might just be, we've asked the question, and if people don't agree to it, then we'll just back off and we'll change tack and not implement what we were looking at implementing. Just picking up on something you said before as well, I think it's worth noting that we've got a planned future session, actually, that talks about bit of pay negotiation stuff, but also threat of industrial action. So if you've got an interest in that area, we can talk through some of the things that we've seen in the past 12 months regarding threats of industrial action and how the legal framework there works. We have had a question that I just want to address before we wrap up today. Do you have to agree to derecognition with the trade unions? No, I mean, if it's statutory recognition, so the CAC have forced a process on you, then you as the employer can apply for derecognition at the end of the three-year period, and the CAC will then look at that application. So in a way that recognition has been forced on you, the derecognition would be forced on the union if they weren't able to establish a certain level of support. Obviously, that's under the statutory scheme. Like I said before, if you've got voluntary recognition with the trade union from the outset, then normally those voluntary agreements will say something like it can be withdrawn at any time. So you basically just
look back at your agreement.
Yeah, look back at your agreement. I don't have the data to hand as well in terms of how successful the applications are. I was having a look through it earlier. It is on the CAC website. I'll probably also post a link to that on LinkedIn. So if you don't follow us on LinkedIn, then please do, and you'll get some further information. Just to finish off, what I'd say is please do check out our sessions on Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcast. If you search for Employment Law 101, I think we're up to about 36 back recordings now of the different sessions that we've done over the past few years. So there's a whole heap of information on there covering all sorts of random topics related to hiring people, dismissals, reorganizations, DE&I, flexible working, hybrid working, all of that good stuff. So you can certainly hear more of mine and Adrienne's dulcet tones on that.
If you want to,
you might have had your fill today. Our next session is 2 weeks today, same time, 11 o'clock. It's on the 16th of November. I think we're going to be looking then at, there's a lot, I've just jumped out at me in the media this week, but I had this plan for a long time. And that is just, again, sticking with cost of living, but older workers delaying retirement and how that's really impacting on progression, opportunities, diversity in the workforce. People working for longer because of the cost of living crisis. So join us for a discussion around that. Otherwise, thanks very much for joining us today. And we look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks' time.
Enjoy your day. Thank you.
Cheerio.